Margaret's going to talk about things. I'm not going to talk about things until we get to the Q&A stuff. I'm just going to read you a passage. I wrote two utopias. One of them is overtly anarchist. That's The Dispossessed. It's the first and, so far as I know, the only anarchist utopia. Then some years later, being kind of uncomfortable with the utopia that kind of is like a blueprint for what the future should be, you know, so on. I wrote this book called Always Coming Home, which is a real mess. And I think is more deeply anarchist than The Dispossessed, frankly. But a lot of people just think I was being primitivist and thinking we should go back to living with nature and, you know, stuff. But actually, it's more subversive than the other one. But the people who write books about books mostly haven't sort of seen that. But it's really hard to read bits out of because all the bits are interconnected with all the other bits. So not wanting to take too long tonight, I'm just going to read you one piece from The Dispossessed. And Margaret asked me to read a bit that showed where the protagonist, Chebec, was kind of at odds with his own people, his own ideology, but I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. Okay, well, you know. This comes actually quite late in the book, and it's the part in the book where perhaps he most clearly perceives what he's been doing. If you don't know the book, he's a physicist who's grown up in this anarchist world where things were not going altogether well and people were beginning to act really kind of like capitalists and things. So he goes to the neighboring world, the sort of parent world, and things aren't going too well there either, and he gets into the revolution. So the poor guy's been kind of tossed back and forth between the ideals of his society and the realities of human nature and stuff. So here he is towards the end of the book with his wife, Takver. Long after Takver had fallen asleep that night, he lay awake, his hands under his head, looking into darkness, hearing silence. He thought of his long trip out of the dust, remembering the levels and mirages of the desert, the train driver with the bald brown head and candid eyes who had said that one must work with time and not against it. Chebec had learned something about his own will these last 4 years. In its frustration, he had learned its strength. No social or ethical imperative equaled it. Not even hunger could repress it. The less he had, the more absolute became his need to be. He recognized that need in Odonian terms as his cellular function, the analogic term for the individual's individuality, the work he can do best, therefore his best contribution to his society. A healthy society would let him exercise that optimum function freely, in the coordination of all such functions, finding its adaptability and strength. That was a central idea of Odo's analogy. It's kind of the founding book of his culture. That the Odonian society on Anaris had fallen short of the ideal didn't, in his eyes, lessen his responsibility to it. Just the contrary. With the myth of the state out of the way, the real mutuality and reciprocity of society and individual became clear. Sacrifice might be demanded of the individual, but never compromise. For though only the society could give security and stability, only the individual, the person, had the power of moral choice, the power of change, the essential function of life. That the Odonian society was conceived as a permanent revolution. And revolution begins in the thinking mind. All this, Chebec had thought out in these terms, for his conscience was a completely Odonian one. He was therefore certain by now that his radical and unqualified will to create was, in Odonian terms, its own justification. His sense of primary responsibility towards his work did not cut him off from his fellows, from his society, as he thought. It engaged him with them absolutely. Footnote here. I'm talking about a scientist, a physicist, but of course I'm also talking about artists or anybody with a job to do that they know is their job. He also felt that a man who had this sense of responsibility about one thing was obliged to carry it through in all things. It was a mistake to see himself as its vehicle and nothing else, to sacrifice any other obligation to it. That sacrificiality was what Tocqueville had spoken of, recognizing in herself when she was pregnant. She'd spoken with a degree of horror, of self-disgust, because she too was an Odonian, and the separation of means and ends was to her too false. For her, as for him, there was no end. There was process. Process was all. You could go in a promising direction, or you could go wrong. But you didn't set out with the expectation of ever stopping anywhere. All responsibilities, all commitments thus understood, took on substance and duration. So his mutual commitment with Tocqueville, their relationship, had remained thoroughly alive during their 4 years separation. They had both suffered from it and suffered a good deal, but it had not occurred to either of them to escape the suffering by denying the commitment. For, after all, he thought now, lying in the warmth of Tocqueville's sleep, it was joy they were both after, the completeness of being. If you evade suffering, you also evade the chance of joy. Pleasure you may get, or pleasures, but you will not be fulfilled. You will not know what it is to come home. Tocqueville sighed softly in her sleep as if agreeing with him and turned over, pursuing some quiet dream. Fulfillment, Shevik thought, is a function of time. The search for pleasure is circular, repetitive, atemporal. The variety seeking of the spectator, the thrill hunter, the sexually promiscuous, always ends in the same place. It has an end. It comes to the end and has to start over. It's not a journey in return, but a closed cycle, a locked room, a cell. Outside the locked room is the landscape of time, in which the spirit may, with luck and courage, construct the fragile, makeshift, improbable roads and cities of fidelity, a landscape inhabitable by human beings. It isn't until an act occurs within the landscape of the past and the future that it is a human act. Loyalty, which asserts the continuity of past and future, binding time into a whole, is the root of human strength. There's no good to be done without it. So, looking back on the last 4 years, Shevik saw them not as wasted, but as part of the edifice that he and Tocqueville were building with their lives. The thing about working with time instead of against it, he thought, is that it's not wasted. Even pain counts. And I will read one thing from Always Coming Home. This also comes very late in the book. And if you don't know the book, oh Lord. It's very complicated. It's these people who might be have lived in California about 15,000-20,000 years from now, and they are really different from us. They may even be slightly genetically different from us. That's not made clear in the book. But they live in a small, contained society in a small valley, which these days we call Napa Valley. The book is a description of them and their culture, and one story of one of them. They remember us as the people with their heads on backwards, if at all. They live in a world which was very, very severely damaged and has come back together in parts. So this is a message from the people of the houses of Earth in the valley to the other people who were on Earth before them. In the beginning, when the word was spoken, in the beginning, when the fire was lighted, in the beginning, when the house was built, we were among you, silent like a word not spoken, dark like a fire not lighted, formless like a house not built. We were among you, the sold woman, the enslaved enemy. We were among you, coming closer to the world. In your time, when all the words were written, in your time, when everything was fuel, in your time, when houses hid the ground, we were among you, quiet like a word whispered, dim like a coal under ashes, insubstantial like the idea of a house. We were among you, the hungry, the powerless, in your world, coming closer to our world. In your ending, when the words were forgotten, in your ending, when the fires burned out, in your ending, when the walls fell down, we were among you, the children, your children, dying, your dying, to come closer, to come into our world, to be born. We were the sands of your seacoasts, the stones of your hearths. You did not know us. We were the words you had no language for. Oh, our fathers and mothers, we were always your children. From the beginning, we are your children. Thanks.
Hello, everyone. My name is Margaret Kiljoy. I just recently edited a book of interviews with anarchist fiction writers about the intersection of politics and fiction, which obviously Ursula K. Le Guin was a part of and actually the start of. Right now, I'm on a book tour from Baltimore, and I gave my first talk about this. I'm going to talk about some of the historical anarchist fiction writers. I'm going to talk about some mainstream fiction writers who actually identify as anarchists. I'm going to talk about some other stuff. And I gave my first talk at the Baltimore Book Festival last year, and anarchists often have like anarchist book festivals, but in Baltimore they actually cooperate with the normal book festival, and they have a radical book pavilion and have speakers come and talk. And so that was a really good opportunity for me. But I got really nervous to talk in front of, you know, a large crowd. Imagine that. And so I was walking around the book festival, and I was trying to figure out what I was going to talk about, and I ran across these two large wooden signs, and painted on them was the top 100 English language novels of the 20th century. And I looked at that list, and I realized that three of the top five were written by people who came up in my research explicitly about anarchism. Numbers one and three were by James Joyce, who identified both with individualist and syndicalist traditions of anarchism, mostly in his youth, but stayed philosophically interested in the idea throughout the rest of his life. And number five was by Aldous Huxley. And Aldous Huxley, in the introduction to one of his later books, said, "What the world needs now is decentralization of a Kropotkin-esque manner," which people are laughing because that's anarchism. Kropotkin's one of the most important 19th century anarchist theorists. That's Huxley saying the world needs anarchy. And then I looked at the rest of the list, and of the top 100, 11 were written by people who came up explicitly in my research about anarchism. And that wasn't even in the broader category of actual radicalism. That didn't include a lot of people that I recognize on my own as like really important feminist writers and really important people writing about a lot of other different really important issues. And I thought about that, and then I walked around and I saw a theater company was putting on an Oscar Wilde play. And I thought about how Oscar Wilde in the 1890s, he's a playwright and fiction writer, someone came up to him from like a pulp magazine like about the theater and came up to him and basically accusatorily they were like, some people have been calling you a socialist. And he gets really offended and he's like, no, I'm not a socialist. I'm something of an anarchist, I believe. And then he went on to say, but the dynamite policy is very absurd indeed. So then I figure, okay, so I should talk about what is anarchism. But in my mind, if I have to talk about what is anarchism, I have to talk a little bit about what is fiction, because to me, they're both just really natural ideas that sometimes need to be explained. So, okay, so when I think of fiction, I think of George Washington, and he's like this tall, maybe a little shorter. I don't know, I think about George Washington a lot. And so he decides to go out and cut down a cherry tree. I don't know why. And he goes out behind his house, he's this tall again, and he goes and cuts down a cherry tree, and his dad comes out and says, you know, well, George Washington, because his dad calls him by his first last name, George Washington, you cut down that cherry tree? And he says, I cannot tell a lie, I cut down that cherry tree. Okay, so that whole story is a lie. That didn't happen. That's fiction. That's a myth about why we should tell the truth to authority. Authority is telling us a myth. They're lying to us about how we should tell the truth to them. That's awkward. And that's the power of fiction, unfortunately. But our society is built up around these ideas, around these myths. We create our own identities. We forge our identities from ideas we get. And a lot of them come from fiction. And so one of the important things that we can do as fiction writers is sort of counter that nightmare and present other ideas. Okay, so then what is anarchism? And I like to accidentally misquote Ursula K. Le Guin every step of this way. And in one of her short stories, The Day Before the Revolution, she says, an anarchist is one who, given the choice, chooses responsibility. And I like that as a descriptor of what an anarchist is, because I like that it talks about, to me, the core ideas of anarchism, which is freedom and responsibility, and you need to have both. Because in this society, we live with responsibility to authority, but we don't have a corresponding freedom. And that's really problematic. That's essentially tyranny, to live under a state without consent of being governed. And then you can have the inverse, right? And you can have freedom without responsibility. And that's kind of society's perception of what an anarchist is. And I think about, like, you know, punk kid squatters, like, pissing in the corner of their room or something like that, which, of course, I would never have done, didn't go through that. Okay, so that's anarchism. Not the peeing in the corner, but the anarchism is freedom and responsibility. And it's about how we can't have one without the other, or actually we can, but we shouldn't is the problem. So I started working on this project because I was writing and publishing anarchist fiction in this magazine called Steampunk Magazine. I was publishing my own fiction. I was publishing some of my friends' fiction. But I couldn't seem to come up with other anarchist fiction, and I got really disappointed about that. So I went down to the Bay Area Anarchist Book Fair 2-3 years ago, and I was like, okay, I'm going to get every novel because it's like a big like anarchist shopping mall kind of with like all of the books available about anarchism all in one big giant convention center or whatever. So I was like, okay, I'm going to get all of the novels here. I'm so excited. I'm going to get all the fiction by anarchists or about anarchists while I'm here. And I was there for 2 days, and I found a total of 2 novels in the entire thing. And so I bought them. And one of them is the sort of unfortunately titled My Journey with Aristotle to the Anarchist Utopia, which kind of gets at the problems with activists writing fiction. Because it lacks a lot of the things that fiction traditionally has, like characters or plot or grammar. It's actually a kind of really interesting book to like defend. Okay, Graham Purchase is this green syndicalist who wrote it, and it's this like crazy awesome wingnut theory about like edible cities and stuff like that. And it's actually stuff that like would totally resonate now. It was written, I don't know, in the early 90s, I think. But it's terribly written, and I don't understand. I couldn't actually get a hold of the author to try and interview this project. What I did is I was like, okay, so I'm really disappointed about this. So I actually wrote Ursula K. Le Guin and said, I want to find out more about anarchist fiction. And I knew she had written The Dispossessed. And so I interviewed her, and she was excited about the project. And that kind of got the ball rolling. I started turning up anarchists everywhere. But I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the mainstream folks who identified with anarchism. And then I'm going to get to this PowerPoint presentation that you all be like totally wowed and amazed by, even though you probably won't be able to see it back there. But I'll like read it out. Don't worry. Bullet points and stuff. It's very good. Okay, so I started turning up anarchists everywhere. So I was reading this, or skimming, honestly, this interview book with Henry Miller. And the interviewer says to Henry Miller, Henry Miller is this person who writes all this kind of reasonably abstract modernist fiction. And they say, you know, Henry Miller, you call yourself an anarchist, but you're so organized. And he's like, yeah. And then, no, it's a joke. Don't you see? You call yourself an anarchist, but you're organized. And Henry Miller's like, yeah, totally. Absolutely. And this really bothers me because someone has the gall to write a book-length interview with someone and know their politics, but not actually look up their politics and what that actually means. And, you know, they didn't have Wikipedia, but like I think they could do it. They could come up with what anarchism is. But they didn't. And so then the interviewer gets really flustered and says, well, why do you call yourself an anarchist? And Henry Miller's like, I don't know. I like read Kropotkin and shit. Like, what? And this is what is really interesting to me, because people, like, if you do research about literary anarchism, you come up with, like, the literary bomb throwers, you know, the people who, like, throw literary bombs because their books are so crazy that they're, like, exploding. And it includes Henry Miller in this because he's writes crazy. And that's not why Henry Miller was an anarchist. Henry Miller was an anarchist because he identified with the political philosophy of anarchism. And that gets really frustrating for me. Okay, so then Anthony Burgess, who wrote Clockwork Orange and then, like, later apologized about it for the rest of his life, kind of, particularly about the misogyny in the film. Anyway, he was being interviewed, and he said, I never had any money, so I guess I'm an anarchist. And then Kurt Vonnegut was giving a talk one time, and someone, like, stands up in the audience, and I don't remember if they interrupt him or if they're asking him a question at Q&A or something, but they're like, Mr. Vonnegut, why are you ruining the youth of America? Or some other such horrible nonsense. Like, people actually say that? Like, and now one of you is going to, like, ask me this afterwards. But, and so he just gets flustered and walks off stage. He's like, I don't want to deal with this. And he just leaves. And the next day he talks to the media about it. And he says, I don't understand what's so hard to figure out about my ideas. I'm a world citizen, I'm a pacifist, and I'm an anarchist. And then there's Tolstoy, War and Peace, all these, you know, famous long books and such, this Russian author. And he didn't identify as an anarchist. He said, the anarchists are right about everything, except that you can use a revolution, a violent revolution, to create an anarchist society. Since then, he's been largely adopted by Christian anarchists and is essentially like, when you say the anarchists are right about everything except one thing that's not actually a core belief of anarchism, I kind of feel like it's okay to lump you in. And kind of one of the rude things about my research is I only included people who like explicitly identified as anarchists either in print or let me bully them into identifying anarchism. If you read my book, that's kind of the subtext. Ursula was the first person I bullied into that.
Why are you ruining the youth of
So that didn't include a lot of people who didn't explicitly identify as anarchists, who probably kind of did, or at least are really, really important to anarchists, and that includes people like Marge Piercy, who, you know, writes societies of anarchist, you know, societies and all of these anti-state things. A lot of the 1970s feminist science fiction writers were all, you know, writing from a anti-authoritarian leftist perspective. And then I came up with also a lot of people who interacted with anarchism. So Kafka was involved in the anarchist groups in his youth, and he may have stayed identify with them the rest of his life. We don't know. He was mostly kind of a quiet participant, but he very much was. Tolkien wrote a letter to his son, and it says, the older I get, I become more and more of an anarchist, philosophically speaking, not bearded men with bombs. Once again, it's sort of a reoccurring theme. Although, as we get into the PowerPoint presentation, not all anarchist writers are against the bombs. And then there's Camus, who is like a fellow traveler to the anarchists, and he was always like the anarchist's best friend. He helped defend Sacco and Vanzetti. He helped defend other anarchist prisoners. He wrote for anarchist papers. He just personally didn't explicitly identify with it, but he wrote a lot of stuff that's really important to us. H.G. Wells has a quote. First, he wrote this horrible anti-anarchist slander called The Stolen Basilisus, and then 10 years later, he has this quote about how the proper role for any society is to move towards anarchism. And now I'm going to get to the PowerPoint presentation, which my friend Art Noos is going to help me by holding. Because unfortunately, this PowerPoint presentation is very small on a pad of paper. So, anarchism in fiction, a very serious presentation. This person is saying yay, their shirt says no lords, no rings. So first we have Dambudzo Maracera. Dambudzo Maracera was born in Rhodesia then. It's now Zimbabwe. He was very poor. He got accepted into a school because he was very smart, but it was a newly integrated school, so he got kicked out because he was protesting all the racism. But he was like a really good writer, so they accepted him to Oxford. Okay, so this quote on this panel. He wrote all these books, but he didn't write in the proper Marxist realist style that post-colonial African writers are supposed to write in. And that was like a problem to the post-colonial African writers, you know, that he was like betraying them by writing like in a, you know, whatever, not representing the needs of their nation. And so his quote is, if you are a writer for a specific nation or a specific race, then f*** you. So then he goes to Oxford. And for those who can't see, in 1977, he's expelled for the attempted arson of his residence hall. And so this is a drawing of Oxford with flames. It might not actually have been totally on fire, but it's represented that way here. And then this person is running out of the building saying, I'm so wealthy and my school is on fire. That's not Dembadzo, because Dembadzo is poor. That's a wealthy person. So he gets expelled, and he becomes a squatter, and he's living in squats and on the streets and parks and stuff like that. And while he's a squatter, he writes a lot of really important books, a lot of books that people really like, and they give him this award. So he goes to the award ceremony, and I kind of imagine it taking place in Hogwarts. At first, I thought I was just like a jerk and assumed that like everything that happens in England happens in Hogwarts, but actually I found out that Hogwarts is based on Oxford, so I'm not totally off the mark. So he goes to this award ceremony, and he's like, I don't want your recognition. So he gets drunk and smashes all the dishes and like throws them at the ceiling. So, and then he continues to write more books, and then his books become more explicitly political, more explicitly anarchist as time goes on. And then he goes back with a white filmmaker back to Zimbabwe to film. He fires the filmmaker for being a racist and then dies homeless on the streets of AIDS. And then we have Stepniak. Someone's actually come up to me after one of these presentations, and actually Stepniak was a social democrat, not an anarchist. I don't know. He came up in all my research as an anarchist, but one person has challenged me on this. But I think that what he did is cool enough. He lived from 1851 to 1895. So he was a Russian soldier, but he quickly was like, I don't really want to be a Russian soldier. So instead he fought in a guerrilla insurgency, wrote a book on guerrilla warfare, and then he went to Italy to participate in the first act of propaganda by the deed that the anarchists did. So, once again, there's flames coming out of buildings. In 1877, Stepniak and more than 30 other armed anarchists liberate two towns in Benevento, Italy, burning tax and ownership records. And so that's Town Hall on fire. Once again, I don't even know if they had town halls. And they're marching away with the red and black flag. I actually don't think they had red and black flags back then either. But it's very important symbolism. And the rejoicing peasants say woo, but that part's true. Because the priest came out of the church and said, these people have been sent by God to liberate us. Because, you know, what do peasants need with the government? Just this thing that comes and takes their money every now and then, much like now. And so they did this to two towns, and then they marched away, and then they all got arrested. And then they got out of jail 3 months later because it's like a crazy time of social upheaval. And he goes back to Russia where he gets involved in anti-police brutality activism. In 1878, Stepniak assassinates the chief of the Tsar's secret police in the streets with a dagger and gets away. For those who can't read, he says, why are you holding a flag while you're stabbing me? Which is a very good question. This person says some like internet stuff. I think they're from the future, just like the flag. So he does this, and then he gets away, and then he moves to England and becomes a popular novelist and writer, and he like joins the literati, and he is like important in the annals of English literature as the first Russian national to write a book in English. And he writes mostly about the needs of poor Russian peasants like himself. And then he dies pretty young, hit by a train one night, possibly drunk, possibly suicide. Okay. So this is Louise Michel. Louise Michel was a school teacher in France. She wasn't very popular because she didn't like whichever Napoleon was in charge at the time. There's a lot of them. Okay. And so I write fiction, okay? and not about Napoleon. So she's a writer, I get to that. She's a teacher. She gets fired a lot, but then the Paris Commune happens, and she joins the Paris Commune. What the Paris Commune was that the government goes away for a while. They're off fighting, and they're like, well, the military's away, so let's have a party. And so all of Paris becomes a party, but they don't know whether it's supposed to be a socialist party or a communist party or an anarchist party. So they kind of like bicker, like now. And then they bicker a lot, but they're kind of having a party. And then the government, the army comes back and is like, actually, you have a government. And they're like, no, we're having a party. But then they like, you know, shoot guns at each other and stuff, and there's hot air balloons involved, which is really cool. There's a important historical moment where Louise Michel leads, and I put this in quotes because I think it's the reason she's leading is because she's the one who's like famous. 100 armed women run up on the National Guard, and the National Guard's like, oh crap, we can't shoot women. And so they like all sit down and have wine and cheese and bread and stuff. I think that that's a lie, but it's in the history books. But it kind of sounds like someone making fun of French culture. But so that happens, and then the Paris Commune falls, and the government is reinstated, and pretty much all of her friends are killed for participating, but they refuse to kill her. In 1871, Louise refuses preferential treatment on account of their presumed gender, and specifically she says to the judge, since it seems that every heart that beats for freedom has no right to anything but a little slug of lead, I demand my share. If you let me live, I shall never cease to cry for vengeance. And this is like a judge or something she's talking to. And this is really interesting to me because this is not the way that anarchists roll these days, at least in the U.S. Like, it's usually like, I'm sorry, I didn't know it was illegal to, like, you know, burn that. But that's fine. Like, who wants to go to jail, right? And okay, so she does this, and then she gets deported to New Caledonia, which is actually still a French colony. I didn't even realize that till today. It's a French colony then, but it's still a French colony. She gets deported, and on the boat she converts to anarchism, because apparently anarchism is a religion that you convert to. I don't know, but that's the way it's always written. And she sets up schools for the indigenous people in New Caledonia, and then they have a revolt against France. She participates in that revolt. She's one of the few communards who does. They lose the revolt. She goes back to France and becomes a popular writer of novels, and particularly children's stories, and she continues to travel around till the end of her days talking about anarchism, talking about methods of teaching, and writing books. And she lives to a reasonably ripe old age. And she's considered very important in French literature, but she's not actually quite as important as the last person I'm going to talk about tonight, which is me. Margaret Magpie Killjoy, born 1982, and when do I die? 2184. Because in 2012, a mere 2 years from now, after an evil warlord enslaves the earth, Magpie and 200 other armed anarchists commit regicide, and the whole world becomes an anarchist utopia. The anarchist press largely dismisses the action as vanguardist. But this is capitalism represented by... I mean, that's the evil warlord. And they say, bwahaha. And then I say, have at you, capitalism, and I'm wielding a sword. And then this person points out, maybe, Magpie, we should use guns. But that seems like a good idea, but it's actually really important to be classy. And that's my presentation on anarchism and fiction. And we're going to have question and answer with me and Ursula.
Are we going to both stand here, or what are we going to do?
So wouldn't a government that's so inefficient and incapable of doing anything essentially form a sort of anarchist society in a kind of de facto way?
Doesn't work.
Yeah, I think that in that case you just end up with this thing where you're still somehow responsible, but you don't actually get anything out of it. Like, you know, if there's going to be a government, it should probably, like, feed people, but instead it would just probably wage war. But maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. I would rather go about it intentionally.
There's something over here. What are the key differences between anarchism and libertarianism? I don't know what libertarianism is. I have tried to understand, and I'm remain buffaloed. So, Margaret?
A libertarian society still... some libertarians verge on anarcho-capitalism, which by and large is not really accepted by the rest of the anarchist culture, because it's a capitalist system in which you are forming hierarchies and allowing hierarchies... which is different than market anarchism and like all this other weird complicated stuff, but also libertarians by and large like feel like the sole role of government is to protect capital and its existence, and most anarchists want to destroy capitalism. This person had a question.
I love The Dispossessed because it was an undertaking of envisioning an anarchist state, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit about tensions between statist evaluations of an anarchist project and non-statist evaluations.
Only in the sense that Darko Suvin, who is actually a Marxist, pointed out that all utopias, but certainly the leftist utopias, exist without neighbors, which was the trouble with Spain. As somebody who is purely a novelist and not a thinker and not a theoretician in any way, my Dispossessed Anaris works because it's a whole moon. It's a little world. And the other world is way off across space and doesn't bother it. Even so, there's this little tiny spot on the world where the other state impinges, and that's the most dangerous place in the whole world. Yeah, so what do you do in a world of states when you try to have a non-state? What do you do?
I don't know. I'd like to leave them alone and let them leave me alone, but historically that doesn't
work.
Doesn't seem to work.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what was the most interesting thing you both learned to be involved with this project.
This project? I learned he existed. What about you?
I think I went into this thinking that like fiction was a pastime. Like, oh, that's neat. I like writing fiction. And I came out of it actually thinking that like helping construct cultural myths and helping disseminate cultural myths to counter the nightmare of our society is like actually directly useful towards building a more egalitarian society.
And that it's not that easy constructing the myths.
Yeah, totally. Well, I had several years of practice at knowing that was hard at that point.
Anytime I've seen anarchists, we kind of give them... black eye to bigger movements that are actually achieving better things, like in Seattle with the World Trade thing. They were the ones breaking windows, giving the whole movement a bad name. And then here with the peace marches in 93, there's a great anti-war marches going on. And then they were the one, I saw a small group of anarchists holding up the whole march while they kneeled over and lit an American flag on fire. So in fact, if that's the photo that's printed in the paper, that makes it harder to
What you don't see are all the anarchists who helped organize the peace march also.
Yeah. As an inveterate peace marcher, I'm like, oh, God, I've marched around downtown Portland more times than anybody in this room except my husband, I'll bet you. And I did get cross with the self-styled anarchist, the noisy, well, look at me, people. Whereas, just as Margaret said, a lot of the organizers and the people that were keeping it so it worked were also anarchists, but they weren't showing off. So, what do you do?
Did you come across any, in your research, did you come across any literature that shows the path towards utopia, not just describing utopia?
That's his thing that I was quoting Darko Suvin about. Utopia is somewhere else, and the little trick is how do you get there? That doesn't, to me, mean that utopias are useless. In fact, I think they're highly necessary. It's very depressing when all the utopias turn into dystopias, you know. It means that people kind of lost faith that it's no use even trying to think about running things differently, that there can't be any alternatives. If we can't get there right away, we can't get there at all. Well, okay, maybe a utopia is too good to get to entirely, but it's got some good ideas in it. How are we going to ever have better ideas if we don't talk about them? And what better way is there to talk about them than fiction?
The question is, so basically, like, most fiction focuses on a specific individual as a protagonist, and that can sometimes be at odds with the sort of collectivist ideas of anarchism. I feel like other ideas, although I was lambasting the literary bomb throwers or whatever earlier, I feel like there are things that one can do specifically with the form of writing fiction that could be useful. But I also don't think that, I think it's a mistake for people to think that because we're talking about an individual, we're talking about an individual at the expense of the collective. And I think that's part of, because we kind of live in this nightmare that makes us think that the individual is versus the collective. And so I think that sometimes it's easier to understand stories when they're through the perspective of primarily a single person. And I think that's probably why that form developed instead of like a status thing with fangs. I don't know. But I don't know.
You know, every collective is formed of individuals. We live in a highly individualistic society at the moment. But there have been many cultures that have their epics and so on are more about the people than about a person. And there's different ways to come at it. It just depends on what culture you're trapped in at the moment.
I'm sorry, we're pointing to this other person. I apologize.
Okay, where was my head when I started Always Coming Home, which I described as an anarchist book? That's so hard to say. We're talking about 1985, when a lot of you weren't born, you know, toddling around then. I don't really remember very well. I wanted to write a book about. I love the Napa Valley. I've spent my summers and my childhood there. I love that place. I know it well. I wanted to give it a people who were worthy of it. The people who live there now are, there's some good people there, but they're not, we're not using that place right. We're not using California right. We're not using the world right. I wanted to get some people who used the world right. I want to write about people like that. And in a sense, Always Coming Home is about as near a collectivist drama as I could write, because it is about a people more than it is about a person. So it occurs to me that in a sense, I was trying to have a collective hero protagonist. Whether it worked or not is up to the reader. Now, the neighbors don't unite. They're way too anarchist. Sorry. The condors are the bad guys because they definitely get very hierarchical and you know, power hierarchy and statist and stuff, and also sexist and all the rest of jolly stuff, you know, and so on. But there's nobody that unites against them. They basically destroy themselves.
What are we accomplishing by writing fiction in relation to our anarchism and trying to move towards things?
Yeah, what you see your role as.
What's our cellular purpose?
Yeah.
To try maybe to show that there are alternatives to the way that we presently do things and that people tend to think is the only way to do things. That, you know, democracy is good, but it isn't the only way to achieve a justice or a fair share and stuff.
I guess I'm really interested in normalizing radicalism and the, like, countering the thing that I would use as an example is, like, so everyone knows homophobic literature is bad, but less often do we talk about heteronormative literature and how that's, like, a crux of all literature. It's not that individual books that are heteronormative are bad, because clearly it is also normal to be hetero, but it is also totally normal to be queer. And so how do we normalize that? And how do we have queero-normative literature or whatever? I just like the word O in there. So, yeah. And I'd like to have that happen with anarchism as well. There's not a word for, like, stato-normative, but that's, like, most books. And so I'm really interested in making it also be totally normal and acceptable to be an anarchist.
But, you know, this basically begins to require science fiction. Well, it did. It did. But, you know, things are changing. Fiction is loosening up. And you know, science fiction is working pretty close towards being norm. Watch out when that happens. Won't be fun anymore. But